My goal here is to, like Keith already mentioned, that our extension program has been mainly working with climate variability. This has been our focus since 2004, when I went to Florida. And in the last couple of years, we did see a need to start providing information about climate change. And like Keith already mentioned this really well, it's quite a challenge because we have, I always think we have different Floridas. We have the coastal counties where they are really concerned about climate change. Extension agents there really want to start taking some action right now. And we have some extension agents in the rural areas in the ridge, in central Florida. They really don't believe on this very much. So how do we put it all together is a challenge. Before I move, let me say that I want to recognize my co-authors there. Dr. Dusky, she is the assistant or dean for extension in Florida. Dr. Johns, who is kind of the visionary for this program. Basically, how that works is that they have this vision. I just have to implement that. I always like to start with some information about our climate in Florida. I know that most of you probably certainly know that we are in a subtropical with hot and humid summers. But we have some mild winters, which are really important for us because it allows us to grow some winter vegetables, to produce citrus, and to have an ag component during the winter time. That's really important. If you look at temperatures in Florida, it varies in our coldest months, which is January. It would be mean average temps would be varying from 50 in the panhandle to about 68, 69 in the southern tip of the state, in the southern part of the peninsula there. If you look at our summertime, our hottest month is August, July, in some places is in August. The average mean temperature doesn't change much between the state. It varies between 81 to 84 degrees Fahrenheit. Rainfall, in terms of precipitation, we vary from 50 to 60 inches. In the southern part, most of the rainfall is during the warm months. In the panhandle, we have some rainfall during the winter time as well. But that's basically our climate there. And if you look at the drivers of climate variability in Florida, in the Southeast in general, El Nino, like Keith mentioned, is the big driver. And a lot of our work in terms of seasonal climate variability has been based on forecasting the ENSO signal for the next season. El Nino is known to bring a wetter and cooler winter and springs to our area. So this year we are in an El Nino year, and we're expecting a wetter winter in Florida. La Nina, it's a warmer and drier. Normally we have a lot of forest fires during La Nina years. You probably remember some of the headlines in the 2000, 1999, 2000, 2001. We had a couple of La Ninas back to back there, and a lot of forest fires in Florida. El Nino will cause to have fewer Atlantic hurricanes. This season we are in an El Nino year. You probably have seen or in some of the newspapers that we have had a very calm season. In fact, it's below average this year. And there are some other important information, sort of like the probability of freezes. If you look back at the hard freezes that really wiped out the citrus industry in Florida, all of them occurred during neutral years. And with the exception, there was one freeze in January of 77 that was a weak El Nino, but all the others, 83, 85, even late in the 1800s, we had some hard freezes. All of them occurred during neutral phases. So those are the sort of information that we know and we provide to growers. I'm pretty sure that you have seen this many times during this conference. This is the IPCC report, the modern day temperature trends in degrees Celsius. But I want to just point out that here in the Southeast, like Keith already mentioned, we do have, where you have the white crosses is where the trends are significant. And you can see some significant trends in the cooling side for the Southeast. So we are a bit different from the northern parts of the country or the western part of the country. If you keep digging down to the country level now, you see this map showing clearly that with the exception in the southern part of the peninsula, we do have a cooling trend, except mainly in Georgia, Alabama, and the northern part of Florida. They are very different from the west and the northern parts of the country. And it's already mentioned, and so went over this slide, so I'm not going to spend much time here, but we keep digging to the a local level. And you see the trends in Florida. They are variable. Warming trends in the 30s and 40s, then we had the coolings of the 60s and the 70s, and now it seems that we are in a warming phase again, but not a major trend there. Again, the stations, and I apologize for that, I didn't know that, but we have those different stations, the rural areas showing no trend or even a slight cooling trend compared to the urban areas. So the message there is that we are a bit different and we have to take this into consideration. Hurricanes, all of you know, it's a very important aspect. We had many, many questions from extension agents, especially after the 2004-2005 seasons when we had so many hurricanes. The questions, in fact, that's when we started having more questions about climate change in 2006, when they started asking, well, is this due to climate change? Is climate change causing this increase in the number of hurricanes? And there has been a lot of research about this and some discussion. Mostly some scientists believe nowadays that the so-called increase in the number of, in the frequency of hurricanes is mostly due to our ability now to better detect hurricanes. In the past, they only could count the hurricanes that were landing. They didn't know if there was a hurricane. There were no satellites to track hurricanes in the middle of the ocean. There is a lot of debate also about the intensity. I don't think there is any major conclusion there. So there are questions about that, but what we know for sure is that hurricanes can be a major problem for us in Florida. And if looking, for instance, at citrus canker, until 2006, the USDA had an eradication program going on, and after the seasons of 04 and 05, we had to cancel that, and we have to manage the disease because eradication became out of hand due to the spreadness of this problem. 2004, we had Hurricane Ivan that is supposed to be, it's blamed for bringing the soybean rust to the U.S. It went through the shores of Colombia before turning north. And right after Ivan, we found soybean rust in Louisiana, and they believe that it was the main reason why we had soybean rust in the U.S. nowadays was due to Hurricane Ivan. Sea level rise, Keith went already through this graph, and it shows an increase of not major, 3 millimeters, 2 millimeters, more recently 3 millimeters per year. There were some scary maps produced. This shows a very out of possibility increase of 6 meters, but what this would mean in Florida, all this area would be flooded, all sorts of comments. People from North Florida, and sometimes they comment, well, that's not a bad idea. Some others, but you can imagine the commotion that this has caused, and we have to deal with this kind of thing. So the role of extension, that's where we want to start talking. And Keith already did a really good job explaining how do we see the role of extension in this process. We are the link, first of all, between the research and the community. We must develop local adaptation and mitigation strategies. I love the word they mentioned in the first day here during this conference, adaptation. So we're dealing with the adaptation issues. We need to identify the needs, the vulnerabilities, strategies. We need to provide information. I mean, that's the main in education to our communities in Florida. And the main reason why I feel this is so important is because there is a lot of misinformation about this team. If you Google climate change nowadays, you're going to have thousands of pages and all sorts of discussions and opinions about this topic. In our group, one of the items that we consider action items is to increase the climate literacy. Let's start with the basics, explaining all the main drivers of climate variability, climate change, natural causes, anthropogenic causes. And we do that. We have had two sessions with the extension agents. We call in service training. Last one was this one in Lake Buena Vista in September. And we bring not only the extension agents, sometimes we bring some of the stakeholders, and they talk about their needs, their beliefs or not. And this one was interesting, a lot of agents talking about their priorities, and they say, well, really, the economic crisis is my main priority now. It's hard for me to talk about climate change with my clientele. But anyway, there was a good interest, and I think it was a really good turnout for this session. Agroclimate, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but this is, has been our main information system. It's a web system. Maybe just a little over a year ago, we added a new item on climate change, and we're looking for adding more information about that. What it does primarily at this point, we do forecast El Nino. This is a sort of recent graph. You can see high probability for El Nino during October, November, December. We have many other tools that some of them may be shown later during this, this session. What we do, we provide some of the basic information, climate change basics for the Southeast USA. We try to bring science and a balanced approach to this website. Our approach to ag, I think we have to look at the four winds: profitability, sustainability, and emissions reduction, and of course the reduction of the atmosphere, the concentration in the atmosphere through carbon sequestration, etc. So I think that we have to keep in mind that when we design the adaptation strategies, we have to keep the profitability and sustainability of our industry in perspective. Otherwise, we don't have a chance to implement anything. A lot of concerns about with the beef and the dairy industries. There's some of the headlines that were in Florida some time ago. EPA would establish a cow tax. You can imagine this was not very well received. But there were many other aspects. If you look at some of the initiatives across the world now, Japan begins a voluntary carbon footprint labeling. We know this is coming. A month ago or so, there was some headlines that Walmart's going to start asking for environmental impact for all the produce that they are receiving, and also it may include in the future the carbon footprint. So some of our growers started to ask questions about this, and right now we have two projects, one with the Florida Strawberry Growers Association, where they were mapping the emissions during the production process of strawberries in Florida, and comparing that to, not comparing, but trying to look at the footprint for transportation to major markets as well. And also we have a project with the Buck Island Ranch, which is a commercial 10,000-acre ranch owned by the MacArthur Foundation, that they manage it commercially. We're doing the emissions inventory for their operation as well. Just a brief, some initial results we have for the strawberry project. What I found really interesting is when we start mapping those things, you find out that some of the solutions are very simple. For instance, in this case, at the end of the season, they burn the plastic mulch and the drip tapes. And if we start accounting for that, we found out it's about 16-17% of their carbon emissions is just because they burn the plastic. So by stop burning or recycling, you can have an impact with a very simple approach. So we need to keep this in mind. I think that's important that we, under this discussion, we look at all the aspects of the production. This is, Keith mentioned the downscaling, and I think that's important. We're looking at ways that we can engage the clientele, and I think that the best way is if we have these new projects and we show local historical trends. We look at temperature, precipitation, extreme events. We meet with stakeholders. Then we can start thinking about, we need to downscale the GCM outputs. We need to check them with the past weather, make sure they are working, pick the ones that are working better for your region. And then we can meet again with the stakeholders and share the scenarios for 2020, 2050. And then, together with them, we can start looking at impacts, vulnerability maps, and developing the adaptation strategies, not forgetting the climate policies that are going to be put in place, because I believe that some of the climate policies might be more difficult to adapt to than the climate change itself. So we need to look at different types of adaptation there. But the idea is to keep the stakeholders involved in this process. And that's the vision for our program. I think that we cannot forget weather monitoring, seasonal forecasting, and climate change. We can't approach a producer or a grower talking about what's going to happen in 2050 only. I think we have to talk to them what's going on now, what you expect for the next season. By the way, we also have some information for you what's going to be happening in 2050, so we can start talking about this and brainstorm adaptation or mitigation strategies. But we, to keep them engaged, we have to come with an entire package. I really believe in that. So, thank you. That's my presentation. And I'll have to cut myself short because we are right on time for the next presentation. So if you